Today, I'll be recounting a scandal of one of Utah's first senators after becoming a state. This is a classic case of a love affair turned deadly, resulting in the shooting and death of Senator Arthur Brown at the hands of his longtime mistress, Ann Madison Bradley.
She's Sarah.
She's Harley. And we're gaveling in another session of Crime in Congress.
Arthur Brown was born on March 8, 1843, to Asa and Lethia Olympia Brown on a farm near Schoolcraft, Michigan, a small village about 13 miles south of Kalamazoo. At the time, this was largely considered frontier land, and considering this is the mid-1800s on a rural farm, we don't have a ton of information on Arthur's childhood, other than to say that Arthur's parents were rather progressive for the times. I say this because the family relocated to Yellow Springs, Ohio when Arthur was around 13 so that his sisters could attend Antioch College. For those of you who don't know, I did not, Antioch College was founded in 1852 by Horace Mann, a lawyer and congressman from Massachusetts who was a well-known abolitionist and social reformer. Mann is considered by some to be the founder of public education in the United States. He believed that a well-educated populace was essential to a strong democracy. As a result, Antioch College was non-secretarian and co-educational. It was the first college in the country to have women faculty members considered as equal to their male counterparts. And Antioch's curriculum was the same for women and men. Clearly, Arthur's parents greatly valued education for both their daughters and Arthur.
That is so cool.
Arthur, like his sisters, graduated from Antioch College in 1862 and then went on to get his law degree from the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor in 1864. After that, Arthur moved back to Kalamazoo where he became a very successful lawyer. During this time, he tried unsuccessfully to run for the prosecuting attorney of Kalamazoo, but he never secured the nomination.
Hate to see it.
As far as his love life was concerned, Arthur married a woman named L.C., which, guys, for the life of me, I could not find what the L and the C stand for because every document I saw either called her L.C. or, quote-unquote, the first Mrs. Brown. Hint, hint on where this story is going. Anyways, we do know that L.C. was regarded as a girl of excellent education and a reputable family. The couple had one child named Alice in 1876. But it wasn't too long before Arthur took a liking to another woman in his life.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Mm-hmm. Her name was Isabel Cameron. The two met while Isabel was working at a newsstand in the Kalamazoo post office. Now, Isabel was the daughter of Michigan State Senator Alexander Cameron, and, like Arthur, she also grew up around Kalamazoo. Isabel was described as having long dark hair and dark eyes, as well as being a good talker and having excellent fashion taste. Isabel and Arthur hit it off and soon started a full-fledged affair. One newspaper article I read said that while married to his first wife, L.C., Arthur had set up a nice home with Isabel, equipped with horses and carriages, and, paying no mind to the rumors around town, Arthur was also openly seen in public with Isabel.
They were just really going for it. No shame.
None. Unsurprisingly, by the 1870s, Arthur and Isabel's affair was public knowledge. L.C. separated from Arthur, retaining custody of their daughter, Alice. There are also reports that L.C. allegedly tried to shoot Arthur, but missed. And then another source I read said that it was actually Isabel who L.C. tried to shoot when she found the mistress in Arthur's office. Either way, the relationship was donezo, and his friends were putting distance between themselves and Arthur.
Yeah, I'll say, I would do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So, in 1879, Arthur decided to move to Salt Lake City, Utah, with hopes of becoming the U.S. District Attorney for the Utah Territory. However, those aspirations did not come to fruition, and Arthur ended up setting up another successful law practice in Salt Lake.
DA just is not in the cards for him, but it's hard to feel bad for a successful lawyer.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Now, back in the picture comes Miss Isabel Cameron, who followed Brown to Utah to be reunited with her love. And once Arthur secured a divorce from L.C. in Kalamazoo, Arthur married Isabel in February of 1881 in Omaha, Nebraska. The happy couple ended up having a son soon later named Max. Quick aside, because I found this super interesting, but Isabel, Arthur's new wife, was involved in politics herself. In April of 1888, she was appointed as one of two representatives for Utah at the National Woman's Suffrage Association convention held in Washington, D.C. Utah had actually given women the right to vote in 1870, which I did not know. And from there, Isabel really became a prominent woman in Utah politics and worked to educate women on parliamentary law and voting. In the same vein, one of Arthur's sisters was early suffragist Reverend Olympia Brown, which is just kind of a fun tidbit. I couldn't do this case and not mention those 2 points because I did go down a bit of a rabbit hole on that.
I was really impressed to hear how early Utah gave women the right to vote and wanted to look up what state or territory made that move first. It was actually Wyoming in December 1869, meaning Utah was right there with the first states to give women the right to vote.
I did a little bit more research on this and like Utah's statehood and stuff, and it actually turns out later in the 1800s, there was an act passed by Congress that actually stripped the right to vote for women, but neither here nor there. Let's get on with the show. When Arthur moved to Utah in 1879, it was notably not a state, but rather a territory. I say this because it took 6 unsuccessful applications before Utah finally became the 45th state in January 1896. I had this whole bit where I talked more about Utah's journey to statehood, but I've pared it down a lot. Basically, the more or less overarching reason for the rejection of Utah's statehood applications was that A, the US federal government was very uncomfortable with the population of Mormons who practiced polygamy there, and B, they also had concerns with the kind of church state that Utah had turned into, more or less with a number of LDS members turned governors and other officials.
Was Arthur a member of the LDS church?
Notably, no. But once the LDS church officially declared into polygamy in the summer of 1890, Utah essentially had the green light to become a state, which it did in 1896. This is when Arthur's political luck turns around. Arthur had become a popular guy among the Utah Republican Party throughout the 1890s, and in 1896, he was nominated to be one of Utah's first U.S. senators. He ended up garnering enough votes from the legislature to win office. Remember, it wasn't until the 17th Amendment in 1913 that the people elected their senator. Again, Arthur won enough votes to become senator, but he ended up with a short term and only served from January 22, 1896 until March 3, 1897.
Wow, that's a very short term.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of his term, Arthur was not a candidate for renomination. I tried to find some more information on why, which overall yielded little, but in terms of pure politics, I did find that Arthur, as a Republican, was a supporter of the gold standard, which fixed the price of the US dollar to gold. This was a less popular take in Utah where silver was being mined. For example, Arthur's fellow senator at the time, his name was Senator Frank Cannon, a Republican, he switched parties to become a quote-unquote silver Republican, or a Republican who supported free silver, aka making it so money backed by silver was added to the US money supply. That, coupled with the fact that the Utah legislature had flipped to a Democratic majority by the end of Arthur's short term, made it clear that Arthur's time as a senator was done. Arthur's successor was a Democrat that supported unlimited silver coinage. After his stint in the Senate, Arthur resumed his law practice in Salt Lake City. Now I'd like to introduce you to our other big character in this story, a woman named Anne Madison Bradley. Anne was born on January 7th, 1873 in Kansas City, Missouri, a daughter of Matthew and Mary E. Kozag Madison. The family moved to Colorado Springs when Anne was about 8 years old, and Anne received an education in Denver and then went on to work at a clothing store there. Eventually, the family moved to Salt Lake City in 1890, and Anne worked as a clerk in the Salt Lake Water Works Department for 3 years and 8 months, exactly. She quit her job a week before her marriage to Clarence A. Bradley on September 20th, 1893, who worked for the Rio Grande Western Railroad. The married couple had 2 children, Matthew, born in 1894, and Martha Claire, born in 1898.
Fellow 90s babies.
Yeah, exactly. Only 100 years later, I was born. According to the Deseret News, Anne met Arthur at the 1896 Utah Republican Convention in St. Louis, which both he and Anne attended. One report I saw said that Isabel, Arthur's wife, actually introduced them to each other, which does make sense. You see, Anne, like Arthur's wife Isabel, was also very involved with the popular women's clubs of the day. Both Isabel and Anne were involved in the Utah Women's Press Club, Poets Roundtable, and the Utah State Federation of Women's Clubs. In fact, Anne served as the editor of the Utah State Federation of Women's Clubs publication and Isabel was elected as a delegate to the Federation of Clubs held in 1898. So I say all this to say, these women ran in the same circles.
Interesting. He must not have been too concerned that they'd run into each other?
Guess not. In St. Louis, Arthur and Anne hit it off. And once back home in Salt Lake, Arthur apparently got Anne a job as a secretary to the Utah Republican Committee. By the time Arthur was officially elected for senator, the two were close friends. Especially interesting considering the 30-year age gap between them.
Here we go. I don't love this.
It seems that Anne stopped living with her husband after Arthur finished his Senate term in 1899. Apparently, Anne's frequent visits to Arthur's office led to a separation between her and her husband.
Imagine that.
You don't say. Anne later testified that Arthur pursued her around this time, saying, and this will be a dramatic reading.
I would expect nothing less.
I told him that what he wanted would only be sorrow, but he replied, never, never. He was a very strange man. Finally, he became coming to my house at very unseemly hours, and I told him that it must stop. But he answered, darling, we must go through life together. I want you to have a son. Which they did in 1900.
That was so good.
Thank you.
I loved that. Tense. I'm also just laughing at how dramatic they are.
Right. Darling. Anne named her son Arthur Brown Bradley, called Arthur Jr., who obviously, from his name alone, tells us that Anne claimed the baby Arthur's son.
Did Arthur think Arthur Jr. was his son?
It seems like he did behind the scenes, which we'll get into a little bit later, but Arthur definitely did not recognize the boy as his son in court.
It's odd that he would allow this boy to be named his junior if he's not even going to acknowledge that he might be his father.
Right, exactly. Curious. However, from Anne's point of view, the relationship with Arthur is going pretty well, minus the fact that they are both married.
Big thing to overlook.
Right. Arthur and Anne go on a series of trips where Anne sees forward momentum in their relationship. So on their trip to Grand Junction, Colorado, Anne claimed that Arthur told her that the only thing stopping him from divorcing Isabel was the issue of dividing assets. To which Anne claimed that she was totally fine with Isabel and Arthur's son Max getting everything in the divorce. She just wanted Arthur. In that same trip, Anne also claimed that Arthur even gave her an engagement ring. Then, on a trip to Washington, D.C., with Arthur and Arthur's daughter, Alice, from his first marriage to Elsie, Anne said that she traveled as Mrs. Brown, once again indicating to her that Arthur was serious about divorcing Isabel and marrying her.
Once again, he makes a life with another woman while married?
Mm-hmm. And this is when things get real messy. I want to also caveat that since this was 1902 in Utah, and I'm working largely from old newspaper clippings, the timeline here gets a little murky, but I promise that everything that I'm about to get into is corroborated and in the correct order from what I understand.
We trust you, and frankly, I wouldn't go digging in old newspaper clips to fact check you anyway, so go off.
Good point. Much appreciated. In spring of 1902, Isabel swore a complaint against Anne charging adultery. When the warrant was served, the deputy sheriff found Arthur and Anne together and took Anne to appear before a magistrate, where Arthur paid for her bond. A couple days later, a similar charge was filed against Arthur. However, both Anne and Arthur's cases were never tried. In September 1902, Arthur put in motion divorce proceedings against Isabel, and Isabel naturally was not happy about it. She told the papers at the time that she was against getting a divorce, especially because she was due to appear in court in England, not sure why, but that divorced women were not allowed to appear in the court. Isabel also said that Arthur was going through some illness at the time and that he couldn't have been in his right mind when he filed the paperwork at the county clerk. Also interesting is that Isabel told those reporters that when she had brought up divorce in the past to Arthur, he had gotten down on his knees and begged her not to leave him.
Not gonna lie, that's an ick.
Mm-hmm. Later that month, however, Arthur and Anne were arrested for adultery. Turns out, Isabel and the Salt Lake City District Attorney at the time hired a private eye who followed around Arthur and Anne. I also found one source that said that the sheriff and Isabel were also in the group with the private eye that followed Arthur and Anne. But regardless, when the private eye and the sheriff saw Anne going into Arthur's room at the place where he was staying at, the sheriff forced entrance and Arthur and Anne were arrested. Arthur posted bail for himself and Anne, which was each $500, or around $3,500 in today's dollars. To me, this does seem a bit excessive for adultery, but, you know, what do I know?
Can you imagine if people were still arrested for committing adultery today?
No, because I think half of DC's population would also be in prison.
100%.
After the arrest, Arthur sent Anne to his ranch in Idaho to decompress slash get away from the craziness.
How nice for her.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Isabel then comes out with a bunch of letters between Arthur and Anne that she found in the two of the apartments slash rooms that Arthur had shared with Anne. These letters were apparently written in code, but Isabel found a cipher, so the letters were easy to translate. The over 300 letters, that's a lot of letters, further detailed the affair. For example, in one letter, Anne asked point blank if Arthur had filed the suit yet, referring to the divorce proceedings against Isabel.
A cipher? He was committed. These days, all men have to do is have a phone password.
Except for the fact that he was being seen in public with Anne.
Yeah, it seems like a real, like, you know, dichotomy there. And also, why would you leave the cipher out to be found?
Totally. So at this point, Isabel is pretty PO'd. And she really spills the tea to the reporters at the time covering the scandal.
As she should.
Isabel told the Salt Lake Herald that she, Arthur, and Anne all traveled to Ogden, Utah for the Republican County Convention in 1898. And while there, Isabel caught the two getting dinner together. Upon seeing Isabel, Arthur grabbed Anne and tried to rush out the door, to which Isabel, and I love this, said to them, "Oh, don't you want to eat your dinner?" And then, on the way back home, Arthur and Anne shared a sleeper train car together.
This man just does not care and frankly doesn't respect either of these women.
Mm-hmm. And remember how I said that Anne had gone to Arthur's ranch in Idaho following their arrest? Well, Isabel then starts talking more trash and says to reporters, "Yeah, Anne went back to my summer home where she left her children to fend for themselves for over a month, quote unquote, barefoot and thinly clad." I just kind of love this. I think it's so human and kind of like reality show coded for Isabel to tell the press, like, yeah, Anne is kind of a deadbeat mom and her kids are raggedy.
This is like 1800s Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, and I'm here for it.
Even more scandalous, though, is the account from when Arthur originally brought Anne to his Idaho ranch with her children. Max, remember, this is Arthur and Isabel's son, told Isabel, his mother, that Anne had pulled a gun on him when he asked his dad to send Anne and her children away from the ranch.
The drama.
Later, when asked if Isabel would consider dropping the adultery charges, Isabel said, and this is a real quote, "An earthquake will have to swallow us up first before I stop this prosecution." And again, I found this in old newspaper clippings. In November of 1902, Isabel filed against Arthur for separate maintenance, which again put her husband's affair on the front page of the newspaper. In that suit, Isabel alleged that 2 months prior, Arthur had abandoned her, and since then and long before had stopped providing her with the proper funds. Much like any grueling divorce today, Arthur Brown came back with his own cross complaint against Isabel in February 1903. In his suit for divorce, Arthur alleged that Isabel was guilty of extreme cruelty against Arthur, including, quote unquote, constant fault finding and continuous insults. Some of these insults included being a drunkard and, quote unquote, having lost all of his manhood and the respect of all of his friends and the community. Isabel also allegedly said that Arthur would die in a gutter in a short time.
These are epic insults. I'm pulling out my notes app as we speak.
Arthur also reported that Isabel said that she often felt like poisoning Arthur and would do it with little to no regret. And finally, Arthur accused Isabel of ruining his political dreams with her insults and accusations.
I think he ruined his political dreams all on his own. I don't think he needed Isabel's help with that.
Agreed. So after all this mess in the courts, it was decided by their friends that Arthur and Anne had to be kept apart. So Anne agreed to go off to California. But surprise, surprise, Arthur could not stay away and the two went to reunite in Pocatello, Idaho. When Isabel got wind of this, she zoomed up to the hotel they were staying at with her lawyer to confront them. As cited from an article called The Gentile Polygamist from a 1984 edition of the Utah Quarterly Journal, here's how that interaction played out, according to Isabel's attorney. By the way, Isabel's attorney does use their, like, proper names, like Mrs. Brown, Mrs. Bradley, but I think it's more fun to sub in their first names. So I'm doing that. Anne came up the stairs when Isabel said to her, "How do you do, Mrs. Bradley? I have wanted to talk to you." Anne sort of cowered against the wall, and Isabel walked up towards her and grabbed her by the throat and threw her down and intended to kill her. I separated them. They got up and commenced talking in a very low tone of voice again. When Isabel grabbed her again, I separated them, and Isabel said, "Let me alone, I will kill her." And I said, "Not when I'm here." Then Anne called out and said, "Arthur, they're killing your dolly, open the door." They were about 6 or 8 feet from the door at the time. There was no response from the senator's room. Then they commenced talking again, the two women. The conversation I don't remember. I went and sat down and looked on. Finally, Isabel rapped on the door of room 11 and said, "Arthur, open up the door or I will mash it in." And the door opened, and the two women went in. Arthur Brown then came out and said to me, "Come in. I don't want to be left alone with them in here." That was about 1 o'clock in the morning. And then there was a general conversation pertaining to their conduct until 7:30 the next morning.
Whoa. And also, I love that he's acting like they're just fighting and he has nothing to do with this.
Right. Isabel ended up leaving and telling Arthur to never speak to her again and to never enter his life. Isabel then returned to Salt Lake City. Also that morning, Arthur gave Anne a gun to protect herself and said, "If my wife assaults you, shoot her." That event happened around March 1903.
That is an insane thing to say about your own wife.
Anne and Arthur went back to his ranch in Idaho, and after a few months, Arthur also returned to Salt Lake. Based on Isabel's statements, Anne had it in her mind that Isabel had set Arthur free and that everything was all hunky-dory. So Anne was surprised when she received a telegram from Arthur that said, "Leave my farm at once." And when Anne returned to Salt Lake, she was even more surprised and horrified to find out that Arthur and Isabel had reconciled.
How? What happened?
Well, in June of 1903, Anne saw Arthur and confronted him about the situation, to which Arthur said, "I have not gone back to my wife in good faith. I did it to save myself from the penitentiary." You see, with the early charges of adultery weighing on Arthur, he had decided to reconcile with his wife rather than risk going to jail. So again, this is where it gets a little convoluted timeline-wise, but basically, the rest of 1903 for this love triangle is a dumpster fire. The sources are consistent in the fact that there was at least a second arrest sometime in 1903 for, again, adultery. There's even one report that said Arthur was arrested on a warrant for criminal intimacy, adultery, in October of 1903 that was served right outside the courtroom where Arthur was trying a case.
Oh my gosh, I forgot that this guy's also just working as an attorney.
Yeah, no, he has a 9-to-5 job. Regardless, in September of 1903, Anne appeared before a district court judge and entered a guilty plea for the charges of 2 counts of criminal intimacy with Arthur Brown. She showed up to the court dressed in a silk dress, a silk coat, and a white veil with Arthur Jr. by her side. She had no attorney present.
The white veil, iconic.
Mm-hmm. Later that day, Arthur, on the other hand, did not plead guilty and ended up standing trial for the charge the next year. In December of 1903, Anne gave birth to another child named Mark Montgomery Brown. Anne swore to the health office that Arthur was the father. Okay, so fast forward to 1904 when Arthur was actually tried on the charges for adultery. While the evidence against him was very strong, the jury ended up finding him not guilty. Also, Anne was never handed down a sentence for her plea. Around this time as well, Isabel, through her attorney, offered Anne a $5,000 home in any part of the city plus $100 a month if she would stay away from Arthur. Today, that would be a $175,000 home, which unfortunately is like a shack in DC, and then $3,500 a month.
Let's be real, that's a parking spot.
So true. Though, of course, Anne refused this payoff. She only wanted Arthur and a name for her children. Because remember, Arthur has never legally called Anne's 2 children by him his own. By the end of 1904, Arthur and Anne's relationship was reportedly very on and off again. Arthur really held a grudge against Anne for telling the truth at her court date and pleading guilty to the charges of adultery. So they kind of go through this period where Arthur seems to be living with Isabel and seeing Anne on the side. And Anne, meanwhile, was trying to start up little side businesses so she could support herself and her now 4 children. Anne wrote a letter around this time that said, and this is another dramatic reading, "Love seems no more than a mockery tonight. I wanted to see you, oh, so much, but it is in vain. I shall kill her, or I shall hate you, or kill myself, or go mad before long. I think I'm going mad now."
I'm kind of feeling for Anne right now. I'm going mad too with all of this.
Right? In 1905, Isabel died of cancer.
Oh, wow, okay.
Mm-hmm. And even as his wife lay dying, Arthur reportedly said to Anne, "I want to be a good man," and that they could finally talk about getting married. And then 2 days after Isabel's funeral, Arthur went to talk to Anne about getting married. He said that they would need to wait a little for the sake of Max, but that he was all in, finally.
He laid his wife to rest like 3 seconds ago, and he's already, I guess, engaged?
Mm-hmm, yeah. By the fall of 1905, the two had set their wedding date for June 2nd, 1906. And Arthur told Anne to get a divorce so that they could be married legally. Remember, Anne is still married to Clarence. So Anne gets that divorce from her husband on the grounds of desertion.
Whatever became of Anne's husband, Clarence?
Well, after he separated from his wife, he ended up taking a series of gigs around the West and got caught up in a bad cycle of drinking hard and gambling. To pay off his debts, Clarence embezzled money from the railroad where he worked at, which landed him a 2-year prison sentence. After being released from prison, Clarence kind of drops off the map. But moving on. Anne got the divorce December 1905, and for the first time in their relationship, both Anne and Arthur are single and able to legally mingle. I mean, wed. But if you thought that Arthur was maybe going to do something right, think again. In March of 1906, Anne bore another child that only lived for 2 days. And then by May, Arthur apparently told Anne that he would and could not keep his promise to marry her. Their June wedding dates came and went, and there was no mention of marriage.
Why?
Honestly, I think he's just a jerk who never had a plan to marry Anne in the first place.
I hate that.
Finally, in fall of 1906, Arthur proposed a plan that they would both move to Goldfield, a mining camp in the state of Nevada, where Arthur said that he would be able to open his own law practice and the two could finally start over and get married. Of course, Arthur proved again that he is the worst and started being super wishy-washy about actually making that move happen. On November 19th, 1906, we come to another breaking point. Anne went to Arthur's house and told him that she would not leave until Arthur agreed to move and marry her. Anne stayed at the house for around 3 days before Arthur finally got her to leave by subduing her with poetry and such. But then Anne showed back up to the house and Arthur finally admitted that he was not going to marry her. After this, Anne went to her sister's house and told her that she now intended to go to Goldfield without Arthur and go forward with opening a stationery store there. This had the promise of being a fresh start for Anne and her children, and Anne started making all the arrangements. Arthur even said that he would pay $250 worth of goods for her store to get her started. Around this time, though, Anne was caught by watchmen several times for more or less stalking Arthur's home, wanting to hear his voice and brandishing her gun, saying that if someone got in the way of her and Arthur, that she would have to get ready because she was, quote-unquote, a vicious woman. Her words, not mine or anyone else's.
She is down bad.
Mm-hmm. Weeks passed by, and Anne confided in her sister that she thought Arthur was maybe trying to back out of his promise to stock her store. Anne's sister said that Anne was, quote-unquote, heartsick, and life seemed to hold nothing for her now. In December 1906, Arthur left town for the capital city of Washington, D.C., because he was set to plead before the Supreme Court in a suit filed against the St. Louis Mining Company by the Montana Company. Interestingly, he told an associate right before he left that if she, referring to Anne, shoots me, my will is in the safe over there. When Anne went to see Arthur's stenographer after he left town, she was told that $200 had been left for her, but that she was to go to San Francisco, not Goldfield. Once again, Arthur had pulled out the rug from underneath her. Anne took the ticket, but in Ogden, she got her ticket changed to one going east to follow Arthur and arrived in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, December 8th, 1906. Anne goes to check in at the Hotel Raleigh, where 3 days earlier, Arthur had also checked in on December 5th. Anne checked herself in as Mrs. Brown, and when asked if she wanted to share a room with her husband, Mr. Brown, Anne said no. She then went up to her room to change, and it was then she asked for the room where Arthur was staying in, which was, coincidentally, on the same floor as her room. Now, when Anne went to Arthur's room, she found a letter from Annie Adams Cascaden, an actress from Salt Lake City who later performed on Broadway. And, fun fact, she was also the mother of Maude Adams, another famous actress who got her start playing in the 1905 Broadway production of Peter Pan. Just another Broadway fun fact for all my theater lovers out there.
We always work it in.
To Anne, the letters indicated that the two were having an affair and could be married soon. This put Anne in a tailspin. One witness saw her rush through the ladies' parlor of the hotel, frantically running from one window to another, looking at nothing and looking very agitated. Found in Anne's room were also torn scraps of letters that she had written after finding the Adams letter. One of these letters partially read, 1 week ago, Sunday, Monday, you could not love me. And there are the letters, Now I see why and how you were so inconsistent.
I need to know what these women's signs are because it's so just over the top dramatic.
The drama is real.
Another letter addressed to a friend said, "These letters are from Annie Adams, Maud Adams' mother. Will you kindly keep them? I may need them in case there is need for defense for any rashness. Publish them."
Rashness for what? Is that premeditation?
Her lawyers say no, but I don't think I agree. Upon hearing Arthur's footsteps in the hallway, Anne went back to his room to confront him. Arthur turned around pale and asked what Anne was doing there. Anne said, "I came to see if you would keep your promise." Moments later, two gunshots were heard by the maid outside who notified management. Anne had just shot Arthur in the pelvis with a .32 caliber gun, the same gun given to her by Arthur to protect herself. The hotel manager on duty, Theodore Talley, hurried to Arthur's room to find Arthur fully dressed, lying on the floor in the center of the room. Anne was standing by the dresser in sort of a dazed condition. When Theodore leaned down to check out the body, Arthur indicated to Anne and said, "She shot me." Theodore then asked Anne for the gun. She handed over her handbag, which did not have the gun inside. And then Arthur said, "You will find the gun on top of the bureau," which is where Anne had put it after shooting Arthur.
So wait, she shot him, and he was the one who had to say where the gun was?
Yes, exactly. Upon investigation by Theodore, he discovered that the bullet had lodged itself in Arthur's abdomen. As Theodore tended to Arthur, he tried to ask Anne to leave the room since she was offering no assistance. But Anne refused and said, "I will remain here. I am the mother of his two children." Although Arthur remained conscious throughout the ambulance ride to the hotel, he didn't say anything else. Anne did not resist her arrest, and when asked for a statement, she refused. However, sitting in jail after the shooting, Anne told reporters very calmly how she had gone to confront Arthur and said that, quote-unquote, "I abhor acts of this character, but in this case, it was fully justified." In the station, Anne was also asked if Arthur was a polygamist, to which Anne replied with this absolute banger of a statement and said, "He is not a Mormon polygamist, but a Gentile polygamist." Following the shooting, there was a lot of public sympathy on Anne's side. Upon her arrest, several Western politicians said that they were willing to pay for her defense. Several local restaurants offered to pay for Anne's meals in the jail. Even Arthur's friends said after that he was shot that Arthur, quote-unquote, "knows no responsibility where he hates, and knows no limit of affection where he loves." Arthur ended up dying in the hospital on December 13th, 1906. Later that month, it came out that Arthur notably did not include his two children from Anne in his will, saying that he did not believe those children were his, and even if they were, he did not want anything from his estate given to them.
It sucks that these children are collateral damage in all of this.
It's also worth mentioning that it seems like there was a signed document from Arthur that acknowledged Arthur Jr. and Martin as his illegitimate children, which Anne reportedly secured in February of 1905. Unfortunately, though, this didn't make any difference for Anne's children, and when a suit was later brought against Arthur's estate on behalf of his sons with Anne, the boys would never receive a cent from their estate.
Those boys are definitely his children, and this is just devastating.
Mm-hmm. So Anne was charged for murder in the first degree for the shooting of Arthur and was tried in Washington, D.C. Her defense was one of insanity. And when I say insanity, it's a bit skewed. Her lawyer took a very misogynistic approach to this defense and argued that women are tiny, weak creatures and that Anne was just one of those small, feeble women who fell in love with Arthur and was driven to the brink of insanity. Which, to be honest, I might too go insane if I were treated like Anne, but I think that's more of a human thing and not a woman thing, but I guess I digress. Anne's lawyer argued that Anne changed courses for Washington, D.C. to ask Arthur once and for all to marry her, not to kill him. And as for going into Arthur's room with a gun, well, the lawyer said that Anne's true intention was to kill herself. And upon seeing the gun, Arthur tried to take it from her and was shot in the struggle for it.
That's different than what she said at the police station.
Right. And that version of the story that Anne told at the police station, she said that Arthur had put on his overcoat after she confronted him, and that when he tried to pass by her, Anne shot him in the pelvis.
Is there any information about the ballistics?
Funny you ask. There is. Anne's lawyer presented the following evidence from Arthur's autopsy. The bullet entered the skin of the abdomen 4 inches above the pubic bone, and its course was downward. The bullet went through the muscle and the skin to hit the pubic bone and then glance inward to cause the mortal wound. The flesh and clothing of Arthur were burned, and a wound on his hand showed gunpowder marks that were also burned in. This, as the lawyer stated, indicated that the weapon was fired less than a foot away, and therefore was evidence that the gun was fired in a close struggle between Anne and Arthur. Conversely to what the newspapers published right after the shooting, which depicted Anne as rather composed, Anne's lawyers also found a slew of witnesses who said that Anne was confused and rambling and nervous and agitated after the shooting, and that she kept crying and asking how Arthur was doing. The jury also heard from another witness that revealed that insanity, quote-unquote, ran her family. Because Anne had one aunt in an insane asylum in Los Angeles, and then another aunt who went through bouts of insanity. Further, Anne's own mother testified that Anne had been hit on the head as a child with a hoe, and had suffered severe headaches for several weeks.
I want to know if there's any family that insanity doesn't run in. I'd love to meet them.
Right. Anne's offense also brought up other instances of emotional whiplash that Anne received at the hands of Arthur. Apparently, when Anne was living on the ranch in Idaho, a pastor came and talked to her to convince her to leave Arthur and told her that Arthur would never keep his promise to marry her. When she went back to Salt Lake to cut things off with Arthur, he got on his knees and begged her not to leave. In addition, the night Arthur failed to get the renomination for Senate, it was Anne that he went to, not Isabel, to be consoled.
Did this defense work? What was the final verdict?
The jury came back on December 3rd, 1907 with the final verdict. Anne was not guilty on the charge of first-degree murder on reasons of insanity.
I did not expect that.
Mm-hmm. Upon her release, Anne had to work odd jobs just to get the funds to return back to Salt Lake. And when she did return, Anne held down several jobs, including a manager of the Railway Educational Association, secretary, and bookkeeper until 1914, when she and her children moved to Prince, Utah. However, there's one more twist to this story. In March 1950, Anne and her sons were once again front page news. The newspapers at the time reported that Anne's son from her husband Clarence, Matthew, wanted to give some food to his friends that Arthur Jr. had prepared. To this, Arthur Jr. said, "If you do, I will cut you." This did not go well, and Arthur Jr. ended up killing his half-brother Matthew by stabbing him to death.
Insanity really does run in the family.
Mm-hmm. At the time, Matthew was 18 years old and Arthur Jr. was only 15. For some reason, the coroner's jury ultimately found the stabbing an accident. Don't ask me how, I'm not sure. It was 1915 in Utah, and the story is mostly about Arthur. But as for Anne, she returned to Salt Lake City in 1921, where she ran an antique store called My Shop in several occasions around the city. She died at age 77 on November 11th, 1950 of a heart ailment. Her obituary included no mention of the scandal with Arthur Brown, and instead emphasized her active membership at Salt Lake First Unitarian Church.
You just took us on a journey. I'm both terrified of Anne and want to be best friends with her at the same time.
No, all the women in this story are absolute gems.
Yes, yeah. I'm glad that they don't exist at the same time as me, but they're pretty iconic.
Absolutely. And that is the story of one of Utah's first senators, Arthur Brown. Harley, would you like to gavel us out?